rules, it should be able to go ahead and give me, RF, broadside on both east, west, north, and south. So that might be interesting to go ahead and see how that performs. And the reason why I was asking about the long path, short path, is because, and somebody just brought it up for a second about the backside of the antenna. I think that, is that a way that you could actually figure it out?
Again, it sort of depends upon the antenna design. If it's kind of bipolar front to back, then yeah. But most antennas have a much more complicated radiation pattern.
K2SDP.
Yes, welcome back again, Chris.
Thanks, Roy. Sorry, I was out of HT. The battery went dead. I was just going to say I had contact with Australia and Tasmania, and I recall them being almost the exact same in both directions. But the one way you could find out which direction you're going is the person receiving it at the other end. This wouldn't be done yourself. Although I guess you can do it yourself, but is with a direction finder. So they used to make direction finders. For some reason, they're hard to find now. But I once spoke with a guy in Europe, and he was using a direction finder to tell contacts how they were getting to him. And the direction finder is just sometimes it's a set of antennas, like four or five antennas in a circle or a square. And antenna that receives the signal first, amazingly, I don't know how they do that, at the speed of light, and determine which antenna it hits first, but they do it, and can triangulate the direction that it's coming.
I was on the direction finders at VHF. So if you have any specific questions, I'd be glad to help.
Yeah, they use that for fox hunting here. I don't know if anyone has it set up for HF, but for 10 meters and above, people are using that for fox hunting.
So once I wrote off the FAA as a backup, when someone only had a radio and no direction information, they're lost.
Well, that certainly is a more useful purpose for fox hunting equipment than just having the door prize of having won the fox hunt.
WB2 TVE.
Yes.
WB2 ZZ.
Yeah, WB2 TV.
Yeah, I just want to chime in on the long path. So I had the long path once. I can't remember where I went or what it was, but it was actually FT8. I know a lot of people don't like FT8. But, yeah, it made contact by itself, but in reality, I used to like whispers. I can see where I'm going, and I know that time I did do long path because I actually saw it, because I saw the reporting stations report back, and I saw my path. My path is actually a long way, so... whatever everybody wants to say about FTA, it does have its purposes, And that's my comment for the day. And by the way, very good, interesting conversation, everybody. Thank you. WB2TVE.
Just for the record, I don't have anything against FT8. You get wallpaper. You get all stations. If you want to just make contacts, it's an extremely brilliant algorithm that Joe Taylor and Frank came up with. I have nothing against them. I have nothing against FT8. It's sort of how you use it. If you use it consciously, that's great. I have my doubts about guys who kind of set it up on autopilot. Then it's your computer that should be getting the worked all states certificates, not actually the ham.
True. I believe that I might be wrong, but the legitimate version I use, WSJTS, I believe, doesn't work like that by itself. You can't set it up just to automatically do everything. I think you have to have some interaction. And, you know, I mean, I know you have nothing against SDA, but some people I have heard say that. And to be honest, the new ham, I had no club, I had nobody, I didn't have any other ham to talk to. I was all by myself. I'm like, oh my goodness, is my rating even working? So FCA was nice. At least I knew my rating was working. I made some contacts, and, you know, for lack of better terminology, it's almost a gateway drug, you know? Like, it gets you in ham radio, you start working these places, you feel good, you get confidence. Hey, we try voice. So I think it's like a pathway, you know? Anyway, don't hold you guys up, but very interesting conversation. I always enjoy this Sunday night, by the way. 7-3-9.
I love that analogy. You're very, very strong.
KF2CC with a follow-up.
Yes, Dave. Yeah, Brian?
I just thought of an interesting question. If you have, hypothetically, a omnidirectional antenna. Now, I'm just curious. If you wanted to speak around the world where everyone hears you, how many watts would it take? And what kind of antenna would it take in order to go ahead and establish a solid communication around the world, if that's possible? Maybe an omnidirectional antenna, let's say.
Well, I think the problem is we just talked about Skip. So in a universe that has Skip, it means that there's not going to be one single transmitter and antenna that's going to propagate your radio waves throughout the globe, you know, unless they kind of hug the ground somehow and travel much longer than ground propagation is capable of doing.
WB2AHK.
Yes, Jed?
Yeah, I got another question for you, Roy, but I think the military uses submarines, low, super low waves, a wave, and they drag an antenna behind it a couple miles long, and they seem to get 12,000 miles, or who knows, maybe around whole Earth. I had a question for you, Roy. Do you know approximately only how far from where we are right now, everybody listening on the repeater, is to the North Pole?
No, I'm not very good at geology. You think it's 4,000 miles? It might be.
Where?
I just, unfortunately.
Well, 4,000 is latitude. 4,000 is latitude. So it's 60 versus 90, it's 2/3 of a quarter of the entire Earth.
That makes sense.
My question, Roy, to you?
Yeah.
All right. Assuming, now, in order to go around and get an echo or a long path versus short path, it all depends on the antenna. If you have an antenna that doesn't have a big front-to-back ratio, you cannot prove anything on long path and short path. But let's just say, for argument's sake, some HFers, they actually have this, where they have their antennas designed to have a tremendous forward transmission with very little return in the back, you know, back waves. Do you agree with that, Roy?
Yeah.
All right, so now, let us say, for argument's sake, only gentlemen, could be 5,000, 4,000, but let's think of a number here. North Pole. Somebody has a high-frequency HF Yagi or cubicle quad with very pronounced forward gain, very little front-to-back ratio, all right? And he points it at the North Pole and gets a signal report from somebody in the North Pole. But then he turns his antenna around and he points it directly south from the North Pole. His antenna is now pointing straight down past Antarctica, and that is coming back on the other side of the Earth, but it's getting to the North Pole. Again, long path. How many miles is that, Roy?
Of
How about if you have to go straight down, you had a certain antenna that has tremendously efficient in front-to-back ratio, and he's pointing it due south, away from the North Pole. He's going straight down to the bottom of the Earth. He passes Antarctica, and then he comes back on the other side of the Earth. I think you got to add a minimum of 12 to 15, 18,000 miles to his transmission, making it a long path signal to getting back to the North Pole.
Is a long path isn't defined as going around the Earth the long way?
Assuming you can't transmit through the Earth, you got to go all the way around the Earth. And I don't care what you say, but it all depends on the efficiency of the theoretical antenna. Nobody has an antenna like this. I'm just talking theoretically. If he had a front-to-back ratio tremendously more potent than what the average ham who could pay for an antenna like that would have, you'd have to go all the way around the Earth to get back to the North Pole. It ain't no same 4,000, 5,000 miles to get back to the North Pole.
No. It's about 4,000 miles one way. And the circumference of that, let's say it's 24,000 during the past year. If the circumference is 24,000, the other way is 20,000. So it's 4 one way, 20 the other way, 12 is 24. I know, it's 25. I'm rounding it up.
I differ with you. I'm sorry, but if there was a theoretical antenna and he could point it in any direction and most of his signal goes in one direction, which nobody has an antenna like that, all right? But he first, if he wanted to go all the way around the Earth and get back to the North Pole, and North Pole wouldn't hear him on his antenna. If he's pointing it straight south, North Pole, and he had a tremendous front-to-back ratio. North Pole no longer hears him. He was talking to North Pole directly north, beaming his antenna north. And if his theoretical antenna had a tremendous front-to-back ratio and he points his antenna south, North Pole no longer hears him.
I grew up with high front-to-back ratios. Yeah, he only has 20,000 miles of ship, so the North Pole would only do for the short path. Long path
would see
around long before
it got there. Exactly. So the guy, in my example here, he has this theoretical impossible antenna to build, and he points it at the North Pole. Let's just say, for argument's sake, 5,000 miles. Okay? And the guy hears him, and maybe let's say, for argument's sake, the guy in the North Pole says, they're coming in S9. Right, a good day of propagation. Then the same guy who's sending a signal to the North Pole turns his theoretical antenna that nobody has produced yet. He points it out, right? Now, the front-to-back ratio of his antenna is non-existent. North Pole no longer hears him because he's no longer sending a signal on the short path. Then his signal goes all the way south and all the way back to north. To get back to the North Pole, I'm telling you, it's 18,000 miles.
AG2RY.
Wait a minute. How
do you get
18,000 in particular?
Aha! See, I knew that if I said 18,000, somebody would come out and say, wait a minute, it's actually 12,000, or it's actually 21,000. I knew somebody, if I said 18, I'd get a response. I'm just making a number to prove my idea. 18,000 is non-existent as well. I just made a quick guess, and I knew it was wrong.
David, hold on. Wait a minute. We're discussing right now the dimensions of the planet Earth. The rest of this is secondary.
Will the long path be east and around the Earth, around the planet, to the destination location?
Well, there was a tremendous amount of doubling, so we missed the question.
Okay, I'll ask again. There was a man talked about stringing up a 20-meter beam in the pine trees. There were 16 elements pointed east. Would that be advantageous for the long path?
It would be better than a three-element beam, and it probably would be reasonably true. It doesn't matter if it's a wire antenna or an actual aluminum antenna. I would say if you had 16 elements pointing in one direction and somewhere or other you had the right calculations and you reduced your front-to-rear transmission power ability and you pointed that 16 elements, you would be probably better working. Definitely you could probably find somebody to work. And it doesn't matter for Australia or the North Pole. I'm just talking about a long path and short path. So it all depends on where the station that you want to talk to is located. So let's say you want to talk to a station that's equally distant around the Earth, right? It's exactly 12,000 miles from you, that station, right? At that point, your long path and short path have no advantage, no matter which way you point your antenna, because he's exactly halfway around the Earth. You couldn't have a long path and a short path signal.
Not true. Well, you know, I hear stories about this, and I've had some experiences of my own. And, you know, for some reason, you know, antennas, they propagate in different ways. You know, even a dipole, if you set it up a certain way, could have a stronger signal going in one direction than the other. Maybe it's not common, but, you know, it still can happen.
Anything could happen. You could have a long path by accident, depending on conditions.
QSL. And, you know, of course, you have to have some kind of signal strength, maybe an amplifier. If you're running 100 watts in a dipole, you're probably not going to have as much luck working the long path, although it can happen.
Sorry to take it, Roy. So the discussion about long path and short path is meaningless. It's just a matter of what happens on a particular day at a particular time and a particular antenna that a station has. You may possibly be transmitting, and the guy will hear you long path, or not. So it's no guarantee. That's all. I'm just saying that it's just for hams to experiment with. There's no reason why we want to do that in the first place, and it's fun to do something like that, but it's nothing scientific, really.
Sure, it's good. It's a good practice. Ham radio is a fantastic hobby. There's a lot of great things people can do with it, and I'm 100% into it. Thank you.
Okay, very good, David. I just want to add some words from John, KD2BD, who's a guy who listens to us from New Jersey and communicates in the chat room. He said, let's see, W2VL is at bearing 311.92 degrees and is 5,373.31 miles from the North Pole. He says the North Pole is at an azimuth of 100.80 degrees from W2VL. In other words, the North Pole isn't north as far as the Great Circle paths are concerned. So that's John's comment.
Sorry to bother you again, Roy. Let me see if I have it. All right, so to anybody listening, the important parameter of the experiment that us hams could have if we had this tremendous antenna that could transmit only in one direction on HF, okay? Despite the fact, Roy, that you said the North Pole is not exactly north from us, is exactly the thing. So there's no such thing, hardly ever, that we're ever going to work a station exactly perpendicular or, you know, exactly completely around the world that you're going to find that station completely, you know, the north and the south aligned or whatever the degrees are. It doesn't matter if it's north, south. It could be at an angle. And it's hardly ever you're going to run into anybody that's exactly center of Earth going around the Earth. So the whole thing is moot, M-O-O-T. It's moot. You're hardly ever going to find a station exactly 12,000-something miles away. So we're just talking theoretical stuff, and it's not for anyone to want to plan to do. It's just fun thinking about it. That's all.
There's two North Poles, astral and magnetic, and the difference is no explanation. Some around 13 degrees, if I remember right, and magnetic north is slowly moving from Canada to Russia over the next 200 years.
VHT.
Yeah, Jim?
Thanks, Roy. KD2VHT. This is an interesting topic, and it gets more interesting when you print out an azimuthal map from your location and you realize that by radio, Europe is not east of us. It's somewhere much further northeast. And you go, what? But an azimuthal map which shows the actual direction of different places definitely paints a different picture of this whole scenario.
You don't need a fancy map. You can see Europe is way off the receiver is on Google.
South Africa is 9,800 air miles from New York. You can call the short path.
Oh, hold on. If you ever go to Northern Europe, all you have to do is compare sunrise and sunset compared at home. And you'll find that in Northern Europe, you know, in Northern Europe, it's a lot longer day in the summer, a lot shorter day in the winter than here.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame that the whole idea of owning a globular map, you know, in your study has kind of gone out of fashion. But I guess that's due to the fact that maps have to be rewritten very frequently. It's interesting, you know, I mean, you take things for granted, unfortunately, except for these interesting conversations to have everyone kind of wake up and realize that things aren't quite the way we think of them, and the devil is always in the details.
Well said, Roy.
Okay. So
I tried. Yed?
I've been to Europe a couple of times in the summer. And it suddenly gets dark for like 10:30 at night.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I mean, it'll do that. You go up, you know, closer to the poles and such.
Yeah. And also, in places like Norway, it's like Sweden's famous. In the winter, Sweden gets like 3 hours of daylight a day, and the suicide rate is affected.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but we're kind of wired that way. We need a certain amount of daylight. Some people think it has something to do with the pineal gland. Other people just, it's some cross-connection between our optic nerves and our brains. But just recently, there was this ridiculous thing. Some people paid to ship flat earthers. I forget if it was Antarctica or the North Pole, just to have them, you know, stand there and watch how the sun behaves and ask them how the hell their flat Earth model accomplishes this. And it drove them crazy, I heard.
That's just what we need is more crazy.
Yes, we have an endless supply of it lately. If you need more, it's on tap.
Tap 2CC.
Yes, Brian?
Okay. Well, I've been listening to this, and I feel it's time I make a little contribution. I don't know if it's going to be much. But my NFED halfway before I upgraded it was basically pointing of the wire was running, okay, from the southwest to the northeast, okay. Therefore, if you look at the broadside pattern, okay, you're getting more to the, a little bit to the west, okay. I'm sorry, change that. you're getting a little bit to the south, okay, and you're getting a little bit to the northeast southwest, okay. So, with that being said, I was able to use a site called QSO Map. That's QSOMAP.com. And I was able to basically take my ADA file from QRZ and LOCW and merge them and take all those contacts and say, display them, okay, on the map. And it became like 98% pretty much in line with the broadside. And those were the countries that I was getting. So it followed a very close parallel.
Okay, that's good to hear, because you know, not all antennas are well-behaved, and all kinds of weird variables can have an effect. Yes, Ed.
Don't forget, your antenna is not floating in free space. The mathematical models assume your antenna is either floating in free space or floating in the air at some particular height that you program in over an infinite resulting flat plane. I will wager that you're lucky, because I will wager that your antenna is not floating in free space over an infinite resulting flat plane. You have, it's probably near your house and near trees, and they all change the pattern a little. And if you're nearby overhead wires, if you're near the roof and you have metallic things on the roof, they all change the pattern a little. When you add it up, it's pretty random. But, you know, the basis holds.
Yeah, I agree with Ed. Matter of fact, we've had this discussion many times. You know, some people kind of say, why? I know a guy who has a G5RV and he loves it. I have another friend who has a G5RV and he hated it. You know, they're the same G5RV. True, they're probably the same G5RV, but they're not in the same location. And the location can have a dramatic effect on the characteristics of any antenna. So, unfortunately, you can't just kind of plug it into an equation. There are some finer degrees of controllability of antenna simulation software. You can actually define what kind of a ground plane you're placing it in, but that's still rather granular. So that's the problem, that there are too many variables that we cannot put into an antenna simulation software to get a really meaningful result. You have to just build one and test it out and see how it works, unfortunately.
Roy, you want to hear my heresy tape?
Sure.
I am a ham radio operator. If somebody answers me, I figure out where he is, and I enjoy it, and I stop worrying about it after that. I don't care long path, short path, or how close it matches my expected antenna pattern. I enjoy the contact. It's ham radio. There's a time I have to be very precise. Ham radio, I hear.
Well, you see, you get paid to be precise. So, you know, being precise is just going back to work, you know. Dick, may rest in peace. Used to have a routine where he said he'll answer any technical question on the air, but he doesn't want anyone to email him the technical questions because that's more like consulting, and he gets paid for consulting.
Comment.
Sure.
KD2BHD. A lot of people are not going to like this, but I've made a discovery about radio. Some people use radio to talk to people. Other people use people to talk to radio. It's a painful reality, but that's some people are solely based on the technology, and some people are solely based on the people that are on the other end of the technology, and there's a continuous spectrum in between. It's a little uncomfortable, but that's the reality I've come to recognize. Back to Roy.
Okay, in your description is kind of a bipolar type of thing. I tend to think, well, probably the more you look into it, the more poles there are. So I see tripoles at the very least. There are people who like to talk to other people. There are people who like to play radio, and you need to have another human being to do that, which I think is your two poles. And then there are guys who are just trying to figure out what's going on. And as soon as they fix stuff, they move on to something else to fix. And they almost never actually end up talking to too many people, either to talk to them as people or to talk to them as excuses to use the equipment.
Wait a minute, Roy. I have a test. A very simple.
Okay.
All right. Consider an antenna. And you want to measure the impedance with a simple, common piece of test equipment that will give you in one number a previous characterization. What is that test for?
Repeat the question again, please.
There is a simple one number, which is a very useful general purpose characteristic of an antenna, will set out. You usually measure it by putting a transmitter power through its meter, and you read the forward power, the phasor power, and then you calculate E, ... fill in the blank.
I assume you're alluding to standing wave ratio, but, you know, I mean, you know, reverse power is important as long as you kind of know what the attenuation factor of the transmission line is.
You're overstating it. You answered my question. You said standing wave ratio.
Okay, but unfortunately, a lot of people really rely entirely. You know, I've had more than a few people who have antennas that are little more than dummy loads, and they don't understand why they can't communicate with the whole world, because their SWR is decent.
Yeah, true. A dummy load, your SWR is perfect. Here's the point. Here is the point. You say SWR, not visual, for voltage standing wave ratio. Professionals measure the visual antenna. Amateurs measure the SWR. Now, of course, the two numbers are absolutely identical, but it tells you about the mindset.
Well, I think it's more education and practice. You discuss VISWA in engineering classes. Most people just kind of read it in a book or something and use the slightly simpler term. I mean, unfortunately, other than people who listen to the technical net, especially when Dick was running it, probably wasn't quite sure what people were talking about when they started to talk about VISWA.
N1YDY?
Yes, Hank.
As a 12 or 13-year-old getting into CB,
I had a Grumman engineer try to explain the concept of this law being flat as not necessarily being a measure of efficiency or output, and of course it went right over my head.
Don't ever talk to Grumman engineers. Avoid them. They're the worst. They're horrible. And I know because I am one, or I was one.
Yeah, but you know, I got surrounded by Grumman engineers when I was growing up. I didn't have a choice.
2SDP.
Yes, Chris?
So, I have an interesting quick story since you brought up Dick, and we were talking about antennas and how you really can't tell what they're going to do, even if you think you know what they're going to do. I once, about 20 years ago, put into the chat room, when the chat room first started, before I was a ham, this question, and somebody read it to Dick, and it was before your time, Roy, and he answered it and explained a little bit that I couldn't repeat, but I kind of got the gist of it. So let me drop it for a second. So my question that I had typed in was, I was listening on a scanner, and I would place my scanner, which is basically a handheld, it's a little HT with a little rubber ducky antenna, and I'd place it on the counter on that frequency and just listen. And if I turned that scanner, let's say, whatever, 45 degrees, but left the antenna in the exact same position, so I'm just turning the base without moving the antenna, you know, maybe microscopically, but the antenna stayed in the same spot, all I did was rotate that scanner a little bit on the counter, and I got perfect signal, and if I rotated it back a little bit the other way and walked away, I would lose the signal. And I could never understand why, and the way Dick explained it was, I mean, the antenna wasn't changing and it wasn't moving, so why was my signal changing? It's in the exact same spot. And the way he explained it was everything in the room, including me, the walls, everything, is part of that antenna system, which I always hear the experts discussing, the antenna system, not just the antenna. And just by turning that, the box, the little 6-inch box, that just that angle of that box changed the whole system and would change how it received. And that still amazes me today. And you can do that experiment if you have a little HT, put it on the counter, and just try twisting it and turning it and standing in the same spot and watch how it changes.
It's called multitask.
I think I have a relevant analogy.
Okay.
I know you hate when I oversimplify, but I continue to think it's useful. It's like a hall of mirrors in a funhouse. Stuff's bouncing all over the place, and it's very difficult to figure out what exactly is going on, and it changes every time you turn your body or turn your eyes or move from place to place. I think it's a pretty good analogy for RF propagation, pathways, interference, interactions. But I know I'm oversimplifying.
Royce, and I have a floor. I need everybody's attention.
Certainly, Ed.
Never so short. It's an oversimplification. Royce, you're absolutely 100,000% right.
Why, thank you.
Anyway, I think there's an additional aspect to this. I think that most receivers have some antenna operating tuning mechanism in the chassis, as long as it's not particularly well shielded, that will also interact with the local RF field and give you a slightly different characteristics.
Also, the circuit board is a very large ground plane, too. You're changing its orientation as well. It'd be interesting to change just the antenna itself to see if anything changes. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't.
Yeah, you could do that, or you could really shield the chassis and see if that has any effect. I would imagine that if you shielded it properly, it would undermine the reception capability of the receiver, but you know, you'd have to try that out.
AG2RY.
Yes, David?
Think about this. I don't know if it really is a possibility. The person has a radio. They connect it to an external speaker. Speaker is pretty large in diameter. And you get more clarity from a larger speaker, or at least that's my experience. And so it's much easier to hear signals coming from the receiver. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, the frequency capability of speakers are somewhat dependent upon, you know, the surface area, the range of the element and such. So, yeah, it's easier to reproduce undistorted lower frequencies for a larger diaphragm speaker element than for a smaller diameter speaker element. So that will improve the ability to perceive speech. We like to hear the entire, 3K range of human speech at the very least. So, the bigger the enclosure, usually the better the fidelity.
Well, due to larger speakers, I emphasize the lower frequencies. The higher frequencies tend to prefer smaller, but with proper design,
yeah,
fairly wide range.
Intelligibility versus fidelity. Fidelity adds to intelligibility. If you have a speaker with a passive filter, frequency filter, then maybe that also would be useful.
Well, when it comes to single sideband and such, you only want to go up to about 3 kilohertz. So you don't really need a small speaker for better fidelity of your highs. You need your mids and your lows. That should suffice for at least HF, single sideband signals.
What about bandwidth filters?
Well, bandwidth filters will, depending upon what you mean by bandwidth, if you mean RF bandwidth, It'll limit your range depending upon the band that you're taking your single sideband signal. If you take your single sideband signal that's about 3 kilohertz and you narrow it to kind of get rid of the noise around it, you're going to decrease its fidelity by, depending upon if you're cutting off the low end or the high end. But, you might get rid of some of the background noise, but you'll have it be less understandable.
QSL. Well, that works for me. To have a bandwidth filter and passive audio filter on the speaker.
Well, that brings up something I want to ask you myself.
Okay.
You were there in 2019, Ham Radio University, 2019. My neighbor talk on receiver design, so how they design, not how they do it, but receiver fundamentals. I'm seeing if the SRU people let me do it, I'm repeating that again this year. What?
I think that would be a great idea. I enjoyed it. I think I listened to it twice because I was there the year before. I don't remember, but I distinctly remember that one. I think that would be great.
No, I only gave that one once. I've given it to professional associations, but we didn't have anything fancy. You were not in the room that time.
Okay, we talked about it, so that's why I have a little place place the bookmark there. But, I think that would go great. It was a very good presentation. I enjoyed it.
Why did you give a search and description and ask what the guy's listening to?
Okay, well, I guess that presupposes that they were there at HRU, right?
Yeah, No. I want you to describe what it's about. I want, in your words, to make sure that the message that I enforce, not the message that I try to enforce, and then ask if anybody else is going to be in line for. That's all.
Okay, Ed did a very nice presentation on the technology of radio equipment and as it progressed through the years and the different modes and such. I thought it was very nice. I'm interested in the historical development of how the technology advances. So, I don't know if anyone else out there took in that presentation who has any opinions, feel free.
WS2N.
Yeah, Paul?
Recorded when he gave them at Limark, so you probably still get them on the Limark YouTube channel. You just have to look for his presentation. Back to you.
Oh, okay, very good. I don't remember seeing it, but I've looked into that YouTube every so often, so I can see what's available. Yes, Brian?
Okay, I have to run. I have an appointment, telephone appointment in about 10 minutes. So I want to thank everyone tonight for the discussion. I want to thank Roy and everyone else. And all your information is valuable and appreciated. And I shall be back next week. So this is KF2ZZ Clear.
Okay, 73, Brian. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you down the line.
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim?
I wanted to toss out a thought about received audio. I think a lot of times people use, your audio is good, or your audio is strong, or your audio is intelligible, and a lot of times the terms contradict. But, for example, Roy, your audio right now, coming through the digital system that I think you're using, is very intelligible. But it's not very pleasant. It's harsh. Whereas Ed's is a little low, but it's very intelligible and it's very easy on the ear. And there's countless variations on the whole thing. So the thing about the size of the speaker and what tones it accentuates or doesn't has very different, at least three different categories of being classified. Intelligibility, amplitude, and the pleasantness of hearing it without it tearing your eardrums and making you uncomfortable. It's a topic that gets not enough attention, I think. Back to Roy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to, we kind of simplify audio as readability. If you could understand it, that's the most important thing, especially for contesting. You want to get the other guy's call sign. You want to get his signals, the parameters of his shack and what have you. On a somewhat slightly lesser note, it's the ability to be annoyed. Some people, for contest purposes, will make their audio annoying because they believe that annoying audio can be... You perceive it much quicker than anything else. So they'll suffer people who don't particularly like the sound of their transmission for the sake of being recognized as transmitting. And, how and why audio has different qualities is, again, near infinite, especially these days of digital signal processors and digital voice modes. Digital voice mode transmissions take audio and turn it back into digital phoneme codes and then reintegrate the phoneme codes back into English speech. And they all have different weird artifacts. Eric, who used to use hearing aid, he had favorite digital modes that had less artifacts than others. So there's a whole bunch of different qualities. That's why some people really like AM transmitters, because it gives you the best, generally speaking, the best fidelity. You know, it sounds more like a human being than even single sideband. So you know, there's a lot of other qualities that go into how nice a voice can be and how harsh a voice can be. And again, I'm simplifying it by just using the term harsh. Yes, Ed.
I have two comments. One is technical, one is non-technical. Pick one.
Not technical.
I want to thank, I didn't catch the name, I want to thank whoever said that about my voice being intelligible. I have had mental nightmares the past 10 years, and I'm very, very, very upset about how my voice has been raised. But that alone was the most wonderful thing you could call me. It's wonderful. I love the fact that you say it. I cannot overemphasize. Technically, AM is famous for having the best audio sound. Presence. I don't know the technical definition, but sounds like somebody's in the room with you. And the reason AM does that, it's a wide bandwidth. FM is obviously a wide bandwidth. The problems with FM are not bandwidth related. Single sideband is not only restricted bandwidth, but until the advent of direct digital synthesis, which is only about 15 years old, you would never ever was tuned in perfectly. Direct digital synthesis is a miracle. Our powers are part of the waters of the Red Sea to the Israelites. Because direct digital synthesis, when it sets the frequency, you are on that frequency, and it stays on that frequency. And if both the transmitter and receiver are tuned to the same frequency, numerically, you hear them beautifully, unlike any ever heard before. And what I propose, if you have the right digital synthesis, and you are forcing you, make sure you are at easy kilohertz. And if you hear somebody who sounds pretty good, before you tweet it out, put it on it, just round it up in your shoulders. And if you're lucky, all of a sudden, that guy's in the room with you. Back to Roy.
Okay, yeah. But generally speaking, especially old-time technology, you know, there's no real significant artifact for amplitude modulation. It brings its own carrier, so you don't need frequency stabilizing oscillators, and it has the range, good bandwidth, and it has a little artifact to kind of distort the signal with FM as well. But you know, modern day technologies have all these little clever improvements for other things other than fidelity, and so most of the time, you're stuck with a less, more imperfect fidelity, and that kind of might not impact on your readability, but you know, whatever you want to call it, timbre, quality, you know, there's about probably 25 different adjectives for it. So, you know, getting back to Jim's question or comment. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to screw up audio, and, you know, there's only so many phrases you could use for it, so you run out of words after, eventually.
Hey, 22RY.
Yes, David?
QSL. What I do is I add a speaker 4.5, 4.7 inches in diameter, and I connect it to the back of the radio. There's one made by Cobra, a very simple speaker,
It's designed for mobile use, but I use it in the base station. Highly recommended.
Okay, very good.
EHD, let me see if I got it. I've seen a wide range of speakers in the radio that either work or do not work well and need to be supplemented or not by an external speaker. And it seems to be kind of random. Some cheap little radios work way better than expected, and some fancy radios don't work so well. I'm on an IC7300H. The internal speaker is beautiful. I no need to add to it. But it definitely varies completely.
Yeah, I mean, again, there's a lot of different variables. There's very simple, like, you know, what size speaker do you have? Do you have a little teeny tiny one where everything is tinny? Do you have a big one where you get some degree of the lower frequencies? And then the problem is, where do you put the darn thing? Is it bottom, pointed to the base? Is it off to the side? You know, you have to physically put these things places, and then you have to understand the acoustics of you know, none of them have their own speaker enclosure, so they're kind of nestled with discrete circuits and circuit boards and all kinds of things. So, unfortunately, I think most people consider the acoustics of a receiver not on the top of the list of their receivers. Some have more expertise and put in a lot more effort, and they're somewhat famous for that. But others just kind of put it wherever they have an empty space.
HE2RY.
Yes, David?
Well, you know, there are people who believe that an external speaker as close to you as possible and the speaker pointed at your ears so you can hear, you know, loud and clear. As you know, people like to use headphones with, what does that call that microphone? Where it's like an arm that goes around your face. People like to use headphones also to say that you can pick out signals better. I don't know. I've never tried one.
Yeah, I have a headset. It's a Radio Sport headset that I use for HF. It's a headphone with a microphone with an interchangeable microphone element. And even for these forays, I used a lightweight headset with a microphone at the end and, you know, earpieces on either side. I find it very useful. I don't have to think of where my head is directed. The microphone always follows it. Lately, on 10 meters, I've been using my PR40 microphone. So I have a slightly different configuration. But here on the technical net, I have a light Q2. We actually had the distributor for it on the technical net about 6 months ago, the guy who did an article on an April Fool's antenna design.
About that April Fool's antenna design?
Be happy with the setup. I use a stock mic and an external speaker. Very happy with it. You know, if I make a DX contact and they're coming in loud and clear like armchair copy, for me that's like the greatest thing. What a great hobby this is.
Yes, indeed. I agree with you.
April Fool's offer about that. I remember back in the 50s, I think it was. Yeah, this is USC had an April Fool's design. Tell me about yours, and I'll tell you about mine.
Okay, very good. They've been doing April Fool's for decades upon decades, because I used to read it back in the late 60s, early 70s. In this particular design, the joke was that he had a vertical antenna. And he decided to put a carbon cylinder they're hollowed out, and he sawed a portion of the circumference into a kind of a slit configuration, and he was saying that the carbon was acting as a shield except for where it had a gap, and out of the gap